Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for December 6, 2023. I'm your reader, Craig Shives. On the front page, the major article is headlined, U.S. Sanctions Israel. Travel ban announced for extremist Jewish settlers in the West Bank. In a rare punitive move against Israel, the State Department said Tuesday it will impose travel bans on extremist Jewish settlers implicated in a rash of recent attacks on Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken announced the step after warning Israel last week that President Joe Biden's administration would take action over the attacks. Blinken did not announce individual visa bans, but Department spokesman Matthew Miller said the bans were implemented starting Tuesday and would cover dozens of settlers and their families, with more to come if the settler violence continued. He wouldn't give a number and refused to identify any of those targeted due to confidentiality reasons. The decision comes at a sensitive moment in U.S.-Israeli relations. The Biden administration has firmly backed Israel since it was attacked by Hamas on October 7, even as international criticism of Israel has mounted. The Israeli embassy in Washington declined to comment on the development. In recent weeks, the administration has stepped up calls on Israel to do more to limit civilian casualties as the Israelis expand their offensive and target densely populated southern Gaza. The U.S. has refrained from outright criticism of that offensive. It has been increasingly outspoken, however, about settler violence in the West Bank and Israel's failure to respond to U.S. calls to stop it. We have underscored to the Israeli government the need to do more to hold accountable extremist settlers who have committed violent attacks against Palestinians in the West Bank, Blinken said in a statement. As President Biden has repeatedly said, those attacks are unacceptable. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs said Monday that since October 7, at least 8 Palestinians in the West Bank have been killed by settlers. The UN agency said it has recorded 314 attacks by settlers that have resulted in Palestinian casualties, damage to Palestinian-owned property, or both. One-third of the attacks included threats with firearms, including shootings, and in nearly half of the attacks, the settlers were accompanied or actively supported by Israeli forces. Today, the State Department is implementing a new visa restriction policy targeting individuals believed to have been involved in undermining peace, security, or stability in the West Bank, including through committing acts of violence or taking other actions that unduly restrict civilians' access to essential services and basic necessities, Blinken said. He said the U.S. would continue to seek accountability for settler violence against Palestinians, as well as Palestinian attacks against Israelis in the West Bank, and Israel particularly, as tensions are extremely high due to the conflict in Gaza. Both Israel and the Palestinian Authority have the responsibility to uphold stability in the West Bank, Blinken said. Instability in the West Bank both harms the Israeli and Palestinian people and threatens Israel's national security interests. Also on Tuesday, Israel said its troops had entered Gaza's second largest city as intensified bombardment sent streams of ambulances and cars racing to hospitals with wounded and dead Palestinians, including children, in a bloody new phase of the war. The military said its forces were, quote, in the heart, close quote, of Khan Yunis, which has emerged as the first target in the expanded ground offensive into southern Gaza that Israel says aims to destroy Hamas. Military officials said they were engaged in the most intense day of battles since the ground offensive began more than 5 weeks ago, with heavy firefights also taking place in northern Gaza. The assault into the south threatens to fuel a new wave of displaced Palestinians and a worsening of Gaza's humanitarian catastrophe. The United Nations said 1.87 million people, more than 80% of Gaza's population, have been driven from their homes, and that fighting is now preventing distribution of food, water, and medicine outside a tiny sliver of southern Gaza. New military evacuation orders are squeezing people into ever smaller areas of the south. Bombardment has grown fiercer across the territory, including areas where Palestinians are told to seek safety. In the central Gaza town of Deir el-Balah, just north of Khan Yunis, a strike Tuesday destroyed a house where dozens of displaced people were sheltering. At least 34 people were killed, including at least 6 children, according to an Associated Press reporter at the hospital who counted the bodies. Footage from the scene showed women screaming from an upper floor of a house shattered to a concrete shell. In the wreckage below, men pulled the limp body of a child from under a slab next to a burning car. At the nearby hospital, medics tried to resuscitate a young boy and girl, bloodied and unmoving on a stretcher. Israel's assault in retaliation for Hamas' October 7 attack has killed more than 15,890 people in Gaza, 70% of them women and children, with more than 42,000 wounded women and children, with more than 42,000 women, according to the health ministry in Gaza. The ministry does not differentiate between civilian and combatant deaths. It says hundreds have been killed or wounded since a week-long ceasefire ended Friday, and many still are trapped under rubble. Israel says it must remove Hamas from power to prevent a repeat of the attack that ignited the war, when Hamas and other militants killed about 1,200 people, mostly civilians, and took captive some 240 men, women, and children. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said on Tuesday the military would have to retain open-ended security control over the Gaza Strip long after the war ends. His comments suggested a renewed direct Israeli occupation of Gaza, something the United States says it opposes. Netanyahu said only the Israeli military can ensure Gaza remains demilitarized. No international force can be responsible for this, he said at a news conference. I'm not ready to close my eyes and accept any other arrangement. Also on the front page, an article entitled Israel-Hamas War Strains Some Muslim-Jewish Relations in the U.S. Shireen Quezayer was racked with doubt. For years, the school psychologist has been active in Muslim-Jewish interfaith dialogue, but the Israel-Hamas war left her reeling. What are we doing with talking to each other? She recalled thinking, frustrated by a conversation about the exact number of Palestinians killed in an Israeli airstrike. This doesn't work. But she decided to fight that thought and tackle the hard discussions once again. Later, Quasar, who is Muslim, met with women like Aviva Seltzer, the daughter of a rabbi and a Jewish school principal who was raised with the belief that but for the existence of Israel, we'd all be dead. The two had come together for a conference in New Brunswick, New Jersey, convened by the Sisterhood of Salam Shalom, an organization seeking to build trust and friendships between Muslim and Jewish women. These conversations are becoming increasingly difficult, with the war and its polarizing reverberations in America testing and straining some interfaith relationships more than ever. For many, the losses are too personal, the emotions too raw. The latest violence triggered by the October 7 Hamas attack on Israel is prompting some to question the point of these conversations and how to have them, while stealing the resolve of others to keep going. We're very courageous, you and I, Because we don't stop talking, Seltzer told Quasar. The minute we stop talking, there's no hope. Quasar nodded and said, we're doing the hardest work right now. At the event, Sisterhood co-founder Ataya Aftab, a Muslim, told participants that simply showing up was an achievement. Next to her, Roberta Elliott, who's Jewish and the nonprofit's president, said she couldn't have gotten through the previous weeks without my Muslim sisters. They've seen the challenges mount. There are all these barriers now to come to the table, Aftab said in an interview. She's questioned why she's not walking away herself. Sometimes it seems insurmountable to have conversations with people who have a diametrically different viewpoint, Aftab said. Faith is what keeps me here, and hope. Part of the difficulty of discussing the war was underscored in responses to the organization's public call earlier for a ceasefire. Elliott said some Jewish women would have preferred the group advocated for a humanitarian pause instead. More recently, heated debates also erupted over what to call Israel's military action. Tensions flared on members' WhatsApp group. We've had to remind people that they need to step back, that they need to take deep breaths, Elliott said. Still, she said, this is what we've been preparing for, to try to be a comfort for each other and try to achieve something together. But in the Israeli-Palestinian context, some critics say many interfaith efforts fall short. Detractors argue that focusing on Muslim-Jewish relationships also risks inadvertently reducing the conflict to religion, ignoring all factors at play, or overlooking the diversity of communities, including non-Muslim Palestinians and Jewish supporters of the Palestinian cause. Aftab said wading into areas of disagreement, especially after establishing trust, is necessary for meaningful interactions. This isn't a religious conflict, but this conflict is sometimes clothed in religion, she said. I think our faith groups can inspire us to do the right thing, to remedy the wrongs, to stand up for justice, to stand up for life. Andrea Hodos, associate director of the Los Angeles-based New Ground, another Muslim-Jewish partnership, said religion is, quote, not the entire puzzle, close quote, but is a piece of it, and that helping people understand these things is important. Some, she said, are saying, how can you just talk right now? People are dying. But if we're not doing our work to help people see one another, we're all going to remain in our silos, and it actually makes it more dangerous. It's hard for some that the group isn't taking certain positions, Hodos, who is Jewish, said, adding that political action isn't its role. We try to get people who have differences of opinion to be able to hear one another. That way, when they are doing advocacy, they can consider more perspectives and have a compassion for their side and the other, she said. The Kauffman Interfaith Institute held a meeting that highlighted the challenges ahead, said Fred Stella, who is a member of the organization's advisory board. People were looking for statements from us, he said. The question is, how do you respond to something like this without either offending one of the sides or simply mouthing virtually meaningless platitudes? His group has mostly focused on fighting anti-Semitic and anti-Muslim hate, which has risen during the war. The only thing I think we in the interfaith community can do is to continue to remind people of our shared humanity. Interfaith advocates say they've also seen bonds, old and new, nurtured. Even when people are in deep disagreement, there's a great deal of goodwill and attempts to reach out, Hodos said. Not everyone can do it. Some of the groups have just been very quiet, and I think people have, for now, walked away from the table. Others are newcomers. In Teaneck, New Jersey, two high school students and friends, Rada Elbatrawish, who is Muslim, and Leora Pelevin, who is Jewish, said they organized events for conversations and education on the conflict. They wanted attendees to get comfortable with being uncomfortable. The whole point was to really understand the other perspective and why someone believes what they do, said Elba Trawish, who was born in Egypt. Palavan, who has relatives in the Israeli Defense Forces and a rabbi mom who's been involved with human rights organizations, said some participants lauded the importance of interfaith events and the deeper connections of in-person conversations. She and Elba Trawish come from different perspectives, she said, but both want a ceasefire. On page 2, we find an article entitled A New Barbie Doll Honoring Cherokee Nation Leader Wilma Mankiller is Being Met with Mixed Emotions. An iconic chief of the Cherokee Nation, Wilma Mankiller, inspired countless Native American children as a powerful but humble leader who expanded early education and rural health care. Her reach now is broadening with a quintessential American honor, a Barbie doll in the late Mankiller's likeness as part of Toymaker Mattel's Inspiring Women series. A public ceremony honoring Mankiller's legacy is set for Tuesday in Tahlequah in northeast Oklahoma, where the Cherokee Nation is headquartered. Mankiller was the nation's first female principal chief, leading the tribe for a decade until 1995. She focused on improving social conditions through consensus and on restoring pride in Native heritage. She met with 3 U.S. presidents and received the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the nation's highest civilian award. She also met and made remarks about her surname, a military title, with humor, often delivering a straight-faced response. Mankiller is actually a well-earned nickname. She died in 2010. The tribe's current leader, Principal Chief Chuck Hoskin Jr., applauded Mattel for commemorating Mankiller. When Native girls see it, they can achieve it. And Wilma Mankiller has shown countless young women to be fearless and speak up for indigenous and human rights, Hoskin said in a statement. Wilma Mankiller is a champion for the Cherokee Nation, for Indian country, and even my own daughter. Mankiller, whose likeness is on a U.S. quarter issued in 2021, is the second Native American woman honored with a Barbie doll. Famed aviator Bessie Coleman, who was of Black and Cherokee ancestry, was depicted earlier this year. Other dolls in the series include Maya Angelou, Ida B. Wells, Jane Goodell, and Madam C.J. Walker. The rollout of the Barbie doll featuring Mankiller wearing a ribbon skirt, black shoes, and carrying a woven basket has been met with conflicting reactions. Many say the doll is a fitting tribute for a remarkable leader who faced conflict head-on and helped the tribe triple its enrollment, double its employment, and build new health centers and children's programs. Still, some Cherokee women are critical, saying Mattel overlooked problematic details on the doll and the packaging. Mixed emotions shared by me and many other Cherokee women who have now purchased the product revolve around whether a Wilma Barbie captures her legacy, her physical features, and the importance of centering Cherokee women in decision-making. Stacy Leeds, the law school dean at Arizona State University and a former Cherokee Nation Supreme Court justice, told the Associated Press in an email. Regina Thompson, a Cherokee basket weaver who grew up near Tahlequah, doesn't think the doll looks like Mankiller. Mattel should have considered traditional pucker toe moccasins instead of black shoes and included symbols on the basket that Cherokees use to tell a story, she said. Wilma's name is the only thing Cherokee on that box, Thompson said. Nothing about that doll is Wilma, nothing. The Cherokee language symbols on the package also are wrong, she noted. 2 symbols look similar, and the one used translates to chicken rather than Cherokee. Mattel spokesperson Devin Tucker said the company is aware of the problem with the syllabary and is discussing options. The company worked with Mankiller's estate, which is led by her husband Charlie Soap and her friend Kristen Keel, on the creation of the doll. Soap and Keel did not respond to messages left by the AP. Mattel did not consult with the Cherokee Nation on the doll. Regrettably, the Mattel company did not work directly with the tribal government design and communication team to secure the official seal or verify it, the tribe said in a statement. The printing mistake itself does not diminish what it means for the Cherokee people to see this tribute to Wilma and who she was and what she stood for. Several Cherokees also criticized Mattel for not consulting with Mankiller's only surviving child, Felicia Olaya, who said she was unaware of the doll until about a week before its public launch. I have no issues with the doll. I have no issues with honoring my mom in different ways, said Olaya, who acknowledged she and Soap, her stepfather, are estranged. The issue is that no one informed me. No one told me. I didn't know it was coming. Olaya also wonders how her mother would feel about being honored with a Barbie doll. I heard her once on the phone saying, I'm not Princess Diana, nor am I Barbie, Olaya recalled. I think she probably would have been a little conflicted on that, because my mom was very humble. She wasn't the type of person who had her honorary degrees or awards plastered all over the wall. They were in the tubs in her pole barn. I'm not sure how she would feel about this, Olaya said. Still, Olaya said she hopes to buy some of the dolls for her grandchildren and is always grateful for people to learn about her mother's legacy. I have a warm feeling about the thought of my granddaughters playing with a Wilma Mankiller Barbie, she said. In National and World News, an article entitled Senator Ends Blockade, Lawmakers Waste No Time Approving Many Confirmations. The Senate, in a single stroke Tuesday, approved about 425 military promotions after Senator Tommy Tuberville of Alabama ended a months-long blockade of nominations over his opposition to a Pentagon abortion policy. Tuberville had been under pressure from members of both sides of the political aisle to end his holds as senators complained about the toll it was taking on service members and their families and on military readiness. President Joe Biden called the Senate's action long overdue and said the military confirmations should never have been held up. In the end, this was all pointless. Senator Tuberville and the Republicans who stood with him needlessly hurt hundreds of service members and military families and threatened our national security, all to push a partisan agenda. I hope no one forgets what he did, Biden said in a statement released by the White House. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer teed up the military confirmations for a vote just a few hours after Tuberville emerged from a closed-door lunch with fellow GOP senators and told reporters he's not going to hold the promotions of these people any longer. He said holds would continue, however, for about 11 of the highest-ranking military officers, those who would be promoted to what he described as the four-star level or above. There were 451 military officers affected by the holds as of November 27. It's a stance that has left key national security positions unfilled and military families with an uncertain path forward. Tuberville was blocking the nominations in opposition to Pentagon rules that allow travel reimbursement when a service member has to go out of state to get an abortion or other reproductive care. Biden's administration instituted the new rules after the Supreme Court overturned the nationwide right to an abortion, and some states have limited or banned the procedure. Well, certainly we're encouraged by the news, Pentagon spokesman Brigadier General Pat Ryder said at a briefing on Tuesday. We continue to stay engaged with Senator Tuberville in the Senate directly to words that urge that all holds on all our general flag officer nominations be lifted. Critics said that Tuberville's tactics were a mistake because he was blocking the promotions of people who had nothing to do with the policy he opposed. And now an article from Dubai, United Arab Emirates. Oil company CEOs lead COP28 day with session. Draft of final core document said to be pretty comprehensive. After days of shaving off the edges of key warming issues, climate negotiators Tuesday zeroed in on the tough job of dealing with the main cause of what's overheating the planet, fossil fuels. As scientists, activists, and United Nations officials repeatedly detailed how the world needs to phase out the use of coal, oil, and natural gas, the United Arab Emirates-hosted conference opened, quote, Energy Transition Day, close quote, with a session headlined by top officials of two oil companies. Negotiators produced a new draft of what's expected to be the core document of the UN talks, something called the Global Stocktake. But it had so many possibilities in its 24 pages that it didn't give too much of a hint of what will be agreed upon when the session ends next week. Whatever is adopted has to be agreed upon by consensus, so it has to be near unanimous. It's pretty comprehensive, COP28 CEO Adnan Amin told the Associated Press on Tuesday. I think it provides a very good basis for moving forward. And finally, House Speaker links border to Ukraine aid. House Speaker Mike Johnson told fellow Republicans on Tuesday that sweeping changes to the U.S. border policy would be their hill to die on in negotiations that have already grown tense as Congress considers President Joe Biden's $110 billion package for the wars in Ukraine and Israel and other security needs. Johnson delivered the hardline message Tuesday morning ahead of classified briefings the Biden administration organized to underscore how desperately the aid is needed. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky was scheduled to address the senators via video, but had to cancel his appearance, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said. Instead, the meeting erupted in frustration and yelling as Republicans insisted on including border security in the discussion. Democrats have dismissed the Republican border proposals as attempts to return to the draconian policies of former President Donald Trump. The Senate is headed to a test vote Wednesday, but Republicans promised to block it. The battle is for the border, Johnson said at a news conference. And that does it for today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for December 6, 2023. I'm your reader, Craig Shives. Hello, and welcome to the reading of The Messenger for Wednesday, December 6, 2023. I'm your reader, Craig Shives. On the front page, the main article is entitled Lights at Kennedy Returns for 2023. The magic of the holidays will come alive during the 20th annual drive-through Christmas lights show, Lights at Kennedy. Perhaps North Central Iowa's premier holiday lighting event, it allows families to enjoy the sights and sounds of the holiday season. The lights will be turned on from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. Friday through Sunday at John F. Kennedy Memorial Park, north of Fort Dodge. The lights will be turned on again from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. December 15 through 17 and December 22 through 23. The drive-through light show is choreographed to music and includes bright, beautiful light displays sponsored by local businesses. There will be an archway at the entrance, bright holiday lights, a 30-foot tree, and much more to see at Lights at Kennedy this Christmas. This year, we have the most amount of displays we have ever had, and right now we have about 35 different ones, said Andy Reed, Lights at Kennedy organizer. Since Reed took over Lights at Kennedy 10 years ago, The event has grown significantly. The first year I did it, we had about 1,500 vehicles attend, but in the last 3 years, we have had over 4,000 vehicles come to drive through to look at the beautiful holiday displays, he said. Admission to Lights at Kennedy is a free will donation, but a suggested donation of $5 per vehicle. The free will donations help with the upkeep and improvements to the display and lights so they can continue to hold Lights at Kennedy each year. Historically, Lights at Kennedy used to donate directly to Backpack Buddies, which provides qualifying students with nutritious food to eat on the weekends. However, due to how large the event has become, some of the free will donations go back to Lights at Kennedy to help with the upkeep and improvement to the displays and lights. We still do donate funds back to the community, though, Reed said. They donate some of the funds to the Fort Dodge Noon Sertoma and the Fort Dodge Young Professionals. The Fort Dodge Noon Sertoma is in charge of the Backpack Buddies program, so the donations are still going to that charity, which is why Lights at Kennedy was started in the first place, Reed said. For updates due to weather or other unforeseen circumstances, check out their Facebook page. Also on the front page, an article entitled So Much to See and Learn. CJ Bio America Farm News Ag Show returns December 8 and 9. The CJ Bio America Farm News Ag Show is back for its 21st annual run at the Webster County Fairgrounds Friday and Saturday. Packed with exhibitors, speakers, and plenty of food, the show is sure to please the crowds. We're really excited about the show, said Dana Lance, advertising manager for Farm News. There's going to be so much to see and learn. Lance is especially pleased to welcome back CJ BioAmerica for its second year as the show sponsor. CJ BioAmerica is a great company, and this is a great fit for them in the ag sector, he said. It's just a very community-minded business. The show will run from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. on Friday and 7:30 a.m. to 3 p.m. Saturday. Admission is free. Friday speakers, U.S. Senator Charles Grassley, Republican from Iowa, has been invited to speak at this year's Farm News Ag Show. He is tentatively scheduled to be interviewed by Messenger editor Bill Shea before an audience at 11:30 a.m. on Friday. Next in the lineup is David Cruz, president of Comstock and Farm News columnist, at 1 p.m. on Friday. He will speak on biofuel opportunities with the theme Treading Water While Waiting for Another Wave to Catch. Then Mark Licht of Iowa State University Extension will be speaking at 3 p.m. An associate professor of cropping options, he will speak on out-of-the-box soybean management. Wrapping it up at 5 p.m. on Friday will be Miss Iowa, Alyssa Gotha. She will compete in the Miss America pageant in January, and Lance said she just very well may be the first Iowan to capture the Miss America title. She has such an impressive presentation, Lance said. She spoke at my Kiwanis Club, and she is so sharp. She has diabetes, and that is her passion. She's so informative when she talks to groups. The American Diabetes Association estimates that 10% of Iowans have been diagnosed with diabetes. Lance said it's a topic important to so many people that he is going to bring her presentation to the Ag Show. She does such a great job. I would not be surprised in the least to see her as the next Miss America, Lance said. Saturday speakers, starting off the show at 8:30 a.m. on Saturday, will be Matt Johnson, Director of Happiness for Fort Dodge Lincoln Toyota Johnson, or Lincoln Toyota. Johnson will bring with him an all-new Ford F-150 EV. For those who love the traditional F-150, this will be a chance to kick the tires and see what an electrical vehicle can do. He will do a live demonstration and talk about the power that this electric vehicle has and what that can mean for farmers, Lance said. The first 20 people at the electrical vehicle presentation will receive a free car wash from Fort Dodge Ford Lincoln Toyota. Back at 10:30 a.m. will be a Farm News Ag Show favorite in Kelvin Leibold, ISU Extension Farm Business Specialist. Leibold will be speaking on strategic and tactical planning for your farm. Wrapping up the lineup of speakers will be Chad Hart at 1 p.m. Hart is professor of economics at Iowa State University and has titled his address, Markets, Mischief, and Mayhem for 2024. Come hungry. As always, there will be plenty to eat at the Farm News Ag Show lunch. Will be served or lunch at the Farm News Ag Show. Lunch will be served both days from 11:30 a.m. to 1 p.m. Friday's meal comes from the Webster County pork producers, while the Webster County beef producers will be serving on Saturday. And for the early comers on Saturday, the Webster County Farm Bureau is again sponsoring a full breakfast from Chris Cakes. There will be pancakes, sausage, juice, and coffee to start the day out right. Breakfast will be served from 7:30 to 9:30 a.m. If all that food and entertainment isn't enough, there will also be a grand prize drawing for a three-night stay for two people in Branson, Missouri. We have partnered with Northland Travel to make this possible, Lance said. It's a great trip and even includes tickets to your choice of three shows with several different shows to choose from. Also on the first page, an article entitled First Covenant Choir to Present Christmas Cantata. The First Covenant Choir, a 40-member group of vocalists at First Covenant Church, will be presenting its Christmas Cantata, Creation Will Be at Peace, Saturday and Sunday. The Saturday performance will begin at 5 p.m., while the Sunday one will begin at 10:30 a.m. Both will be in the church, which is near U.S. Highway 169, north of the Iowa Central Community College campus. Please come and be blessed as you journey with the singers, first to the birthplace of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, and we conclude this beautiful cantata with the challenge to witness to all the message of salvation, said Armona Redenius, the choir's director. The cantata will feature songs such as The Little Drummer Boy, Mary and Joseph's Song, Children Go Where I Send Thee, and Creation Will Be at Peace, among others. Narration for the cantata is provided by Tim Anderson, Barb Farnham, Chris Hayek, Arissa Lunson, Shanda Kinseth, Julie Davis, Steve Stamper, David Lass, Joni Cruz, and Todd Redinius. The soloists for the cantata are Micah Flaherty, Don Bergman, Paul Halverson, and Elissa Savoff. The First Covenant Praise Band will be accompanying the congregational carols as well as playing a Christmas arrangement. The band is comprised of David Lass and Armona Redinius on trumpets, Micah Flaherty and Don Bergman on trombones, Lisa Flaherty on piano, Linda Benson on keyboard, and Dean Davis on drums. The cantata is accompanied by Shelley Botorf and Lisa Flaherty on piano, Benson on keyboard, and Davis on drums. And finally on the front page, taking center stage with Neva Caldera. Caldera loves sharing her passion on stage. For Neva Caldera, inspiration brought her to the stage and inspiring people kept her on it. The Fort Dodge Senior High School senior saw a performance at a young age, and the show led her to becoming part of one as well. When I was 12, I watched a production of The Little Mermaid, Caldera said. The way Ariel sang and looked under the lights made it clear to me that I wanted to be in her place. So I auditioned for a musical for the first time ever a few weeks later. I love the feeling of performing and knowing that I might be inspiring someone the way I was inspired. In her 4 years at Fort Dodge Senior High, Caldera has been involved in band, choir, and theater. Outside of the Dodger halls, She does community theater. Caldera is part of the marching and concert bands. I play the tenor saxophone in the marching band and the French horn in the concert band. Caldera said, "I love to perform in concert bands, and on the field it gives me a sense of ease as I mix myself into the melody. Singing in choir with others gives me a wonderful feeling of community." As the days of her senior year wind down, Caldera remembers all of her times on the stage. "Being a senior is tough, but I think the hardest thing to leave behind is the feeling and rush of looking at the cast list," Caldera said. "Although I will continue to perform, it just isn't the same." Early into her final year, speech is now the center of attention. "So far, the best thing this year has been speech," Caldera said. "I have a lot of hope for making Allstate this year with my short film and musical theater groups." Being involved in so many aspects broadens the horizons for Caldera. "It's important for me to be involved with many activities because there are aspects of each of the groups that I can showcase my abilities and passions in," Caldera said. "My favorite moment was when I got to see my name for the lead role as Grace Fryer in Radium Girls, and knowing that someone would believe in me enough to take a chance on me like that." Caldera said Ashley Frederick, French horn teacher, Lindy Mama Krug, French teacher, Al Polson, band director, have been big creative influences on her life. Caldera plans on continuing to act after high school. On page 2, an article entitled "Israeli War on Gaza Enters New Phase." From the Gaza Strip, Israel said Tuesday that its troops had entered Gaza's second-largest city as intensified bombardment sent streams of ambulances and cars racing to hospitals with wounded and dead Palestinians, including children, in a bloody new phase of the war. The military said its forces were, quote, in the heart, close quote, of Khan Yunis, which has emerged as the first target in the expanded ground offensive into southern Gaza that Israel says aims to destroy Hamas. Military officials said they were engaged in the most intense day of battles since the ground offensive began more than 5 weeks ago. On page 3, an article entitled "Supreme Court Signals It Will Uphold a Tax on Foreign Income." The Supreme Court on Tuesday seemed inclined to uphold a tax on foreign income while leaving questions about a broader, never-enacted tax on wealth for another day. On the first issue, conservative and liberal justices voiced concerns that ruling for a Washington state couple challenging a provision of the 2017 tax bill would threaten other provisions of the tax code. After 2 hours of arguments, there seemed to be a consensus on the court that there is room for some narrow ground to decide the case, as Justice Neil Gorsuch said. Such an outcome would avoid what Solicitor General Elizabeth Prelogar said would be several trillion dollars in lost revenues. At the same time, the court would not address the bigger question of Congress' ability to enact taxes based on wealth instead of income. The case argued Tuesday was brought by Charles and Kathleen Moore of Redmond, Washington. They challenged a $15,000 tax bill based on Charles Moore's investment in an Indian company. Backed by anti-regulatory and business interests, they contend that the tax violates the 16th Amendment, which allows the federal government to impose an income tax on Americans. Moore said in a sworn statement that he never received any money from the company, ThyssenKrupp Machine Tools Private Limited. The 2017 tax law that was passed by a Republican Congress and signed by then-President Donald Trump includes a provision that applies to companies that are owned by Americans but do their business in foreign countries. It imposes a one-time tax on investors' shares of profits that have not been passed along to them in order to offset other tax benefits. The provision is expected to generate $340 billion, mainly from the foreign subsidiaries of domestic corporations that parked money abroad to shield it from U.S. taxes. The case attracted outsized attention, because some groups allied with the Moors argued that the challenged provision is similar to a wealth tax, which would apply not to the incomes of the very richest Americans, but to their assets, like stock holdings, that now only get taxed when they are sold. Paul Ryan, the Wisconsin Republican who was Speaker of the House when the tax bill was passed by a Republican Congress and signed into law by then-President Donald Trump, has called the challenge misguided and has said a lot of the tax code would be unconstitutional if that thing prevailed. Democratic Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon said a court ruling for the Moors could stymie legislation like the billionaire's income tax he introduced last week. The Moore case could make it impossible to close those loopholes, Wyden said. Some conservative justices seem to have a wealth tax in mind when they ask Preloger, the Biden administration's top Supreme Court lawyer, about the far-reaching consequences, in Justice Samuel Alito's words, of her arguments. And now to the Messenger editorial, entitled Farm News Ag Show is Friday, Saturday. Full lineup of speakers set. As farmers wrap things up on the 2023 growing season, it is not too early for them to start thinking about next year's growing season. Farm News, a sister publication of The Messenger, is ready to help them do just that with the upcoming Ag Show. CJ Bio America presents the 21st annual Farm News Ag Show, and it will be on Friday and Saturday at the Webster County Fairgrounds, south of Fort Dodge, at 22770 Old Highway 169. The show will run from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. Friday and 7:30 a.m. to 3 p.m. Saturday. At 7:30 a.m. Saturday, there will be a free pancake breakfast sponsored by Webster County Farm Bureau. There will be a big room full of vendors and displays. On Friday morning, U.S. Senator Charles Grassley will answer questions in a live interview format beginning at 11:30 a.m. The lineup of other speakers includes David Cruz, president of Comstock and a Farm News columnist, Mark Licht, associate professor and extension cropping systems specialist at Iowa State University, Miss Iowa 2023 Alicia Gothe, Matt Johnson, co-owner, dealer, and director of happiness at Fort Dodge Ford Lincoln Toyota, Kelvin Leibold, farm and agribusiness management specialist for Iowa State University Extension, and Chad Hart, professor of economics at Iowa State University. But wait, there's more. A drawing will be held for a three-night stay for two in Branson, Missouri, included in its admission to three shows and one museum. The Ag Show promises to be informative and fun. Be sure to put it on your calendar. On page 5, we have an article entitled Florida Discontinues Manatee Winter Feeding Program. From St. Petersburg, Florida, a two-year experimental feeding program for starving Florida manatees will not immediately resume this winter as conditions have improved for the threatened marine mammals and the seagrass on which they depend, wildlife officials said. Thousands of pounds of lettuce were fed to manatees that typically gather in winter months near the warm water discharge of a power plant on Florida's east coast. State and federal wildlife officials launched the program after pollution killed off vast seagrass beds, leading to a record of over 1,100 manatee deaths in 2021. This season, the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service determined the seagrass has started to recover in key winter foraging areas on the East Coast and that there appear to be fewer manatees in poor physical condition going into the stressful colder months. After careful consideration, the agencies are not providing manatees with a supplemental food source at the beginning of the winter season, the FWC said Friday in a notice on its website. However, staff developed a contingency plan, which they will implement if needed. Last year, more than 400,000 pounds of lettuce, most of it donated, was fed to manatees near the power plant in Cocoa, Florida. Manatees are gentle, round-tailed giants, sometimes known as sea cows, that weigh as much as 1,200 pounds and can live as long as 65 years. Manatees are Florida's official state marine mammal, but are listed as a threatened species, also facing peril from boat strikes and toxic red tide algae outbreaks along the state's Gulf Coast. Their closest living relative is the elephant. The starvation problem, something the wildlife agencies call an unusual mortality event, has been traced to nitrogen, phosphorus, and sewage pollution from agriculture, urban runoff, and other sources that trigger algae blooms, which in turn kill off the seagrass that manatees and other sea creatures rely upon. Millions of state and federal dollars are being poured into dozens of projects, ranging from stormwater treatment upgrades to filter systems that remove harmful nitrates from water that goes into the Indian River Lagoon, the East Coast estuary, where manatees congregate in winter. On page 9, article entitled "Extremist West Bank Settlers Will Be Barred from America." In a rare punitive move against Israel, the State Department said Tuesday it will impose travel bans on extremist Jewish settlers implicated in a rash of recent attacks on Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. Secretary of State Antony Blinken announced the step after warning Israel last week that President Joe Biden's administration would be taking action over the attacks. Blinken did not announce individual visa bans, but Department spokesman Matthew Miller said the bans would be implemented starting Tuesday and would cover dozens of settlers and their families, with more to come if the settler violence continued. He wouldn't give a number and refused to identify any of those targeted due to confidentiality reasons. The decision comes at a sensitive moment in U.S.-Israeli relations. The Biden administration has firmly backed Israel since it was attacked by Hamas on October 7, even as international criticism of Israel has mounted. The Israeli embassy in Washington declined to comment on the development. In recent weeks, the administration has stepped up calls on Israel to do more to limit civilian casualties as the Israelis expand their offensive and target densely populated southern Gaza. The U.S. has refrained from outright criticism of that offensive. It has been increasingly outspoken, however, about settler violence in the West Bank and Israel's failure to respond to U.S. calls to stop it. We have underscored to the Israeli government the need to do more to hold accountable extremist settlers who have committed violent attacks against Palestinians in the West Bank, Blinken said in a statement. As President Biden has repeatedly said, those attacks are unacceptable. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs said Monday that since October 7, at least 8 Palestinians in the West Bank have been killed by settlers. The UN agency said it has recorded 314 attacks by settlers that have resulted in Palestinian casualties, damage to Palestinian-owned property, or both. One-third of the attacks included threats with firearms, including shootings, and in nearly half of the attacks, the settlers were accompanied or actively supported by Israeli forces.